Judge Smith has joined us. Mr. Gray, can you hear us? And can you see us? You can't see us. Can you see us now? There you go. So, Mr. Gray, you have 10 minutes to argue your arguments in this case, and you can reserve part of that time if you wish for rebuttal. Most people reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Would you like to do that? I'm sorry, no, thank you. So you've got 10 minutes to argue your side of the case, and Ms. Osborne from the Attorney General's office is here, and she will argue the other side of the case after you argue. Do you have any questions before we begin? Okay, then you can start and tell us your side of this case.
My false conviction was denied by an evidentiary hearing on February 22nd, 2022. I issued before the district court where that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to investigate and gather defense evidence for me to be charged with a lesser included offense. Manslaughter instead of second-degree murder, and for advising me away my constitutional right to personal service, the 24-hour waiting period, and my preliminary hearing to amend the information. Also, where the direct appeal counsel was ineffective for failing to raise claim against trial counsel for being ineffective for reasons I state, and for not perfecting my appeal. My trial counsel failed to be effective because my trial counsel never made me aware if I took my case to trial manslaughter would have been an included offense for the jury. My trial counsel failed to be effective by not advising me I could be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole or second degree murder, and advising me to take the plea that he has never seen anyone receive a life sentence on the back number before. I was sentenced on November 26, 2019. Me and trial counsel had a conversation, and I asked I would receive a sentence of life to life without parole because based off the advice I received from my trial counsel, I had to get a number and have a parole eligibility date. And had I known this information was false, I would have insisted on going to trial, and that they told me the true nature and penalties on the record, I would have withdrew my plea. During that conversation, my trial counsel told me based off his knowledge, the advice I received from him was correct and true, and I needed to file ineffective assistance of counsel and excessive sentencing. On December 11, 2019, trial counsel filed a motion to withdraw for the reasons I wish to raise the argument of ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeals. Your Honor, I feel it's important to note I have no contact with any lawyers from November 26, 2019 to December 11, 2019. My counsel also failed to be effective by failing to investigate important facts like me being picked up from my friend. My friend Nicholas Adderbury's house was the victim, not my mom. And me carrying a knife on my person for weeks for self-protection prior to what happened with all Southern marijuana and being driven to D'Anthony Rodwell's house by the victim on the night of the crime, that marijuana, and supposed to be taken back to my friend Nicholas Adderbury house by the victim to celebrate New Year's Eve. My trial counsel failed to investigate further into my mental health, to understand the issues I faced and the trauma I've been through. That same state of Florida 2015, WL8979736, that is important. My trial counsel failed to investigate my parents' criminal history to understand the patterns of my criminal conduct. He also failed to investigate my mental health and separation anxiety caused by domestic violence in my home, being placed in the out-of-home placement for truancy at school at a very young age. our trial counsel does an investigative evidence of some fraud when it did exist, because our statement to the investigator, I only acted after being verbally attacked and told things about my son and another and the relationship and a lot of other things by the victim. And the statements from Nicholas Abbey and Nicole Myers, Rion Rion makes that police investigators will confirm the verbal attack by the victim. My trial counsel failed to be effective and competent for advising me to waive my constitutional rights to personal service, 24-hour waiting period, and preliminary hearing to submit the information. Had my trial counsel been effective and competent, I received factual knowledge, better advice, and he did a proper investigation to gather defense evidence. The outcome would have been different. I'm confident a jury would have found me not guilty of second or first degree murder. As seen in State versus Floyd 2015, WL897-9736, which is somewhat similar to my case, he received a 30-35 for a plea of no contest to second degree murder. They appealed for this sentence being excessively lenient, and the Court of Appeals court denied the appeal and confirmed the sentence. Even after weighing the factor that him being competent, taking a plea, his age, the facts of the case, his PSI, criminal history, and the outcomes of actions, the Court of Appeals deemed the sentence of 30-35 for second-degree murder not excessively lenient. Considering the rulings on the State versus Boyd, I feel my sentence of life without the possibility of parole is excessive. Based on the rulings from State versus Boyd, direct appeal counsel was ineffective and incompetent for failing to raise the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel on my trial counsel. Because I made her aware that I wanted to raise the claim, I expressed to her about the advice I received and everything within my post-conviction claim against trial counsel. I made her aware of the conversation between me and trial counsel after I was sentenced, and because she failed to raise the claim when trial counsel states on his motion to withdraw his attorney from defendant for the reason that I wish to raise ineffective assistance of trial counsel on direct appeal. Direct appeal counsel deficiently failed to file to make my appeal after being made aware of my claim by me after my conviction and sentence. Failed to raise an effective assistance of counsel on behalf of me violating my constitutional rights under the Sixth Amendment. Also seen on page 20 of my post-conviction, the record reflects that the state did commit plain error when the state was allowed to amend the information after the plea was agreed upon and after the appealant had already entered my plea of no contest. The amended information did change the nature and identity of the offense, and thus it was plain error for me to enter a plea before the state amends the information. Your Honor, for the reasons stated, I feel I'm entitled to an evidentiary hearing to have an opportunity to depose my trial and direct appeal counsel, or at the very least, be directed for a new direct appeal. I'm asking this court to intervene and correct the error of the lower court. I request this court to please review the record de novo for any clear errors on the record that affected my rights in this matter. I would like to note, Your Honor, if when I was asked by the court on the record if I understood the possible penalty, I answered yes, because the knowledge I received from trial counsel when facing a charge that carries a 20-to-life of guaranteed a parole eligibility date. I know this information was false, and it could explain every possible penalty. I would have answered no and would have insisted on going to trial. And the last thing, Your Honor, my claims against trial counsel's failure to investigate did not mean putting blame on the victim. It's me trying to bring light to things I feel is important. Facts for the panel to know, and because I feel some parole should have been my defense, but ultimately, I know even if I feel I was provoked, I should have been more aware of my mental health and my emotions. It's better overall, because I do not feel this situation reflects who I am as a person. action on the court, but if you two have been on lockdown recently, I didn't have time to make a copy and send it to the court for to see if I have a motion. But it's just a motion to withdraw by the defendant, I mean, by my trial counsel. It just states that the reason that he was withdrawn from my case, that for the reason that I wish to raise the argument of ineffective assistance to counsel on direct appeal, that never happened.
Very good. If you've got something you wish to send us yet, Mr. Gray, you may do that. And is I take it your argument is concluded. Is that correct? Okay. Thank you very much. Now, Ms. Osborne, good morning to you, and you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General representing the appellee of the state of Nebraska. This is a post-conviction appeal of a case where the appellant pled no contest to second-degree murder and use of a deadly weapon to commit a felony. The state submits appellant's motion for post-conviction relief was properly denied without an evidentiary hearing because appellant's claims were procedurally barred, insufficiently pled, affirmatively refuted by the record, or they failed to show prejudice. So I'll begin with the procedurally barred claims are those claims that this court should not consider. Appellant raises new claims in this appeal in the initial brief, the reply brief, and more today in his oral argument that were not in his post-conviction motion. And that includes a claim of when the amended information was filed and his Eighth Amendment claim that's in his reply brief. These should not be considered by this court because they were not raised in the operative post-conviction motion. An appellate court will not consider allegations now presented to the district court for disposition through the verified motion for post-conviction relief or passed upon by the post-conviction court. Appellant also reasserted his excessive sentence claim in his post-conviction motion, and that claim is procedurally barred. A motion for post-conviction relief cannot be used as a substitute for an appeal or to secure further review of issues already litigated on direct appeal. That excessive sentence issue was raised and rejected by this court in the direct appeal. Also, to the extent that appellant asserts plain error in his reply brief, and again, I think he reiterated it today, new claims raised for the first time in a reply brief are untimely and will not be considered by an appellate court, and plain error cannot be asserted in a post-conviction proceeding to raise claims of error by the trial court. So for all those reasons, any claims that were not in the motion for post-conviction relief should not be considered in this appeal. Next, I'll address appellant's second claim, which was that trial counsel was ineffective by advising him to waive his right to personal service, the 24-hour waiting period, and a preliminary hearing before he pled to the reduced charge of second-degree murder. The state submits the district court properly found that this claim was insufficiently pled, affirmatively refuted by the record, and failed to show prejudice. So here, appellant did not allege any facts in his motion for post-conviction relief other than his self-serving declarations to show that trial counsel was deficient or that he was prejudiced. Appellant was charged with first-degree murder. The state offered to reduce that charge to allow him to plead to second-degree murder, and appellant accepted that offer. That is the only reason that the charge was amended. The rights that appellant waived when he entered his pleas are rights that are waived at nearly every change of plea hearing. The appellant cannot show that trial counsel's advice that he waived those rights in order to effectuate that change of plea was deficient performance that did not equal that of a lawyer with ordinary training and skill in criminal law. Each of those rights that he waived were explained to him by the district court on the record. And he explicitly waived each of those rights freely and voluntarily. to the extent that he's claiming that he didn't understand the plea agreement, the elements of second-degree murder, or the possible penalties, that is affirmatively refuted by the record, and there's no prejudice, because at the change of plea hearing, appellant stated that defense counsel did explain the charges to him, the amended charge, and he understood the charges. Moreover, appellant explicitly was told that the district court or the state explained all the elements for each of the crimes that he pled to and the possible penalties, as well as the terms of the plea agreement, all of which appellant stated that he understood. And likewise, appellant's argument that he pled to second-degree murder because trial counsel told him that he's never seen anyone receive a life sentence for second-degree murder is also affirmatively refuted by the record. The district court advised appellant that it was not bound by any recommendation of defense counsel or the state in terms of the possible sentence, which appellant stated that he understood. He represented to the district court that no inducements or promises were made by anyone to get him to enter his pleas. And he was specifically asked, has anyone made any promise to you or represented to you in any way what the actual sentences will be in this case if I accept your pleas and find you guilty? And he replied, no. Self-serving declarations that a defendant would have gone to trial are not enough to warrant an evidentiary hearing. So for all those reasons, appellate's second claim was properly denied without an evidentiary hearing. The first claim is that trial counsel failed to investigate a lesser offense of sudden quarrel manslaughter. However, the district court properly found that that claim was also insufficiently pled, affirmatively refuted by the record, and failed to show prejudice. This allegation was conclusory and insufficiently pled because appellant failed to specify what evidence trial counsel would have discovered that would have supported such a defense beyond appellant's own statement that he got upset about his ex-girlfriend dating another man and he killed her by stabbing her 15 times. For a lesser offense of sudden quarrel manslaughter, there must be a sufficient provocation that causes a reasonable person to lose normal self-control. Appellant's post-conviction motion failed to state any specific facts that the victim did or said anything to provoke a reasonable person in Gray's position to stab her 15 times with a kitchen knife, or how trial counsel would have uncovered such facts. He never said that there was an argument or a quarrel. He didn't provide any specific words that were said or actions that were taken before he repeatedly stabbed the victim. He did not allege that his anger about the victim dating another man was even sudden in nature, as opposed to him knowing about this new relationship and reflecting about it for several days or weeks before the killing. His only claim is that he got upset. Being upset about an ex-girlfriend dating someone else is not a legally recognized provocation. An evidentiary hearing is not warranted based only upon the prisoner's legal conclusions about the significance of vaguely asserted failures to investigate. And again, appellant has attempted to add facts to support this post-conviction claim in his reply brief and even more facts today in his oral argument, but those are not part of the operative post-conviction motion and should not be considered by the court. To show prejudice, Gray must allege specific facts that demonstrate but for trial counsel's deficient performance in investigating sudden quarrel manslaughter, he would have insisted on going to trial. In this court's opinion on direct appeal, it discussed the clear evidence of premeditation in this case. This court stated premeditation is indicated by the fact that Gray took a kitchen knife from his mother's house, had it on his person when he entered the victim's car, and manipulated the situation so the victim would end up alone with him, where he used the knife to stab the victim over 15 times in the car as she attempted to flee. Appellant cannot show he would have rejected the state's generous offer to plead to second-degree murder and instead proceed to trial on first-degree murder given the evidence of premeditation against him. And finally, any claim that appellant would have or could have simply entered a plea to sudden quarrel manslaughter at his own discretion is not correct. Appellant was charged with first-degree murder. He had the option to either plead to the state's offer of second-degree murder or go to trial on first-degree murder. Appellant pleading to sudden quarrel manslaughter was not an available option to him. So for all those reasons, appellant's first claim was properly denied without an evidentiary hearing. And unless there are questions from the court, I'd ask that the court affirm the order of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Gray didn't request rebuttal, but do we have any time left?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time left for rebuttal, Mr. Gray. So thank you for participating by WebEx today. And thank you, Ms. Osborne, for being here today. That concludes arguments in State versus Gray. The court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Sinu versus Concordia University. And thank you, Judge Smith, for participating in this case. Justice Miller-Lerman is also recused in this last case of the day, and Judge Strong is going to be sitting in her